This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Last year, tourism in Chattanooga boomed, poised to climb even higher. Quite a different story now, after more than 6 months of COVID-19. Barry White is CEO of the Chattanooga Tourism Company. Barry, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Appreciate you having me.
Tell us how things stand now with tourism in Chattanooga, this stage of the pandemic.
Yeah, so at this stage, we're doing okay. Things are still very difficult in the travel and tourism industry across the country and in Chattanooga. Chattanooga is faring a little bit better than most of our competitors around the Southeast and many cities across the country. Uniquely situated between some major metro areas, Birmingham, Huntsville, Atlanta, Nashville. We're a convenient drive distance from those markets, and we are a familiar destination to a lot of people who live in those markets. So again, with air travel, again, being one of the hardest hit in the travel industry, we're fortunate that we weren't reliant on air travel as a lot of other destinations. So we have that drive-in market. We are a familiar destination. A lot of people in those markets, it's convenient to get to. And then I added on top of that, again, we're extremely fortunate to have not only our legacy attractions, but we're also known as an outdoor. We have a lot of outdoor activity between our natural assets, whether that be rivers, mountains, lakes. So a lot of people feel comfortable being outdoors. So again, we've fared, you know, is it bad? Absolutely. Is it as bad as it could be? It's bad, but it's not as bad, I guess that's what I would say.
Losing Ironman for this year has been a blow.
It has been. Losing both Ironman events this year has been extremely detrimental. The loss, the economic loss of that, and even just the lifestyle. I mean, having people here, having locals who participate both in volunteering and participate in the event itself, you know, it kind of takes away a little bit of who we are now as a community. And those large events, you know, those large events are the ones that are probably going to be the last to return. Even if they're outdoors like that, it's just, it's sometimes difficult to put those on. So those are the ones that have kind of, all those large events, whether it's sporting events, conventions and meetings, reunions, those types of things, they're still probably pretty far off in the distance as far as their return to Chattanooga or any other city in the nation.
And Songbird's closing its museum and its music venues. The Songbird's Foundation continues its work. Right. Also, the Tivoli Theater closed. They started a recovery fund recently.
Yes. Yeah, Songbirds, I mean, really hated to see that loss. We understand that it is extremely difficult to operate in these times, both for attractions and for restaurants. The longer this lasts, you know, it'll be more difficult for hotels to remain open. Again, it's tough all the way around. The last attraction really to come back online was the Hunter Museum of Art. They were closed for quite a while. We're thrilled to have them back open. Again, Songbirds, really hate to see Songbirds. It's such a unique attraction for our community. But we are happy about the recent news that the foundation will stay there. The Choo Choo is going to try to keep the live venues going. And Songbirds Foundation will use that space for live events as well for fundraisers. So there is a little bit of a bright side, but again, really hated to lose them.
What's worked in the virtual space?
Well, the virtual space, I think people are starting to dip their toes back into, again, kind of that meetings and conventions side of things, where maybe hybrid meetings, where you might do something live, make it optional if people do feel comfortable traveling, that they can come in and travel, but it's also going to have a virtual aspect to it, and a lot of times be recorded so it can be replayed to people who couldn't be there, even if they can't participate during the live portion of the event. So I think we're going to start seeing some transition towards those types of meetings. And then just, you know, the more people are on, this is kind of the marketing side of it, the more people are on their computers and on their phones during this time is really kind of where the majority of our marketing is going out in digital to try to reach people when they're on those devices and make sure that they're aware of Chattanooga and aware of what we have here as assets for them.
And where can people go online for more information?
We go to visitchattanooga.com. I would encourage people to go there, residents as well. We have a lot of information for residents. We have a lot of information for visitors. But again, it's really all about that lifestyle, some of the activities. that may be going on, what's open, what's not, how to be safe when you're out and about in Chattanooga. And we'll also have a lot of new videos that'll be posted up there too, kind of reiterating and showing how to be safe when you're out and about.
All right, Barry, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Let's talk about hospice. Dr. Greg Phelps is teaching an online course with that title starting tomorrow at 5:30 p.m., presented in part by the Chattery. Greg is medical director for Aleo Health, Hospice of Chattanooga, and the author of the recent book, Education of a Hospice Doctor. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be back.
You are with us to talk about the online class that you will be offering. Tell us more about it.
It's a combination of the Chattery, Welcome Home, and Hospice of Chattanooga, and it's one of several educational efforts this fall. This one's sponsored specifically by Welcome Home, which is founded and run by my dear friend Sherry Campbell, who is my nomination for Contemporary Saint. She used to be a social worker with Hospice of Chattanooga and felt it was her call to provide hospice services for the homeless, and she's been doing that for a number of years now. She has an establishment over on Germantown Road, and she is moving to an expanded facility off of Access Road in the next few months. So she's doing classes about, this one's going to be called Let's Talk About Hospice and Myths of Hospice. It's about education for the community. Later on, there will be a series called Book of Life that's specifically for healthcare workers and clergy that's done in collaboration with the Chattanooga Association of Clinical Pastoral Care. So there's a bunch of good offerings about end of life, advanced care planning, and all that sort of stuff this coming fall.
One thing that you're going to explore in this particular class online, the many myths about hospice care. Name one.
Yes. In Atul Gawande's MD's book, Being Mortal, which came out in 2014, he talks about he knew very little about hospice and that all he knew about hospice was it was about giving people a morphine drip and letting them go. And the most common myth that we hear is, oh, hospice, you give people morphine and kill them. And I have had that said to my face, which kind of surprised me. Actually, a survey of hospice doctors said more than half of them have had that accusation flung in their face, even by other physicians. But in actuality, patients who are in hospice live longer than their matched counterparts that are not in hospice. I was talking with a physician a year or so ago. I was caring for his mother, and he patted me on the shoulder and he said, man, I don't know how you sleep with yourself at night. And I was like, excuse me, I need to answer that. And I said, our patients in hospice live longer, an average of 3 months longer than they would otherwise. Their care costs less, they suffer less, the families suffer less, and the quality of care is better. So I said, I sleep just fine. I look on it as a win-win-win-win. But people don't know what to say or do about it. We refer to hospice as the H word. As, you know, as soon as you say hospice, it's like saying you have cancer. It's, oh my God, you know, what am I going to do? And so we sometimes will back into it to give the people a feel for what we do rather than what we're called. My good friend Bob Goldman, who used to be at Memorial, would describe hospice services saying, oh, your mom's pretty sick. You know, would it help if I got you a hospital bed? And it's, oh, yeah, that'd be great. And maybe I could get a nurse to come out and check with you and see how she's doing. Oh, that'd be terrific. And maybe I could get some medicines delivered to your house. And, oh, this is wonderful. And boy, you're pretty stressed. How about if I got a spiritual care person or a social worker to help you? That's wonderful. Well, what I just described is hospice. The popular myth is that it's just for end of life, and it's really about quality of life, that we are really focusing on trying to help people live better when time is precious. I guess that's probably the best way I can put it. People don't come to us that are going to do great. I've had patients' families say, oh my God, they're in hospice. I didn't know they would die. I said, well, kind of part of the process. One of the things you have to do is sign a what's called an election of benefits form that says the goal is to stay home and keep you comfortable. We sometimes struggle with that because patients will say, well, I'll come into hospice, but I want everything done. I say, well, you know, we're kind of focused on keeping you comfortable. And there comes a point where you're doing things to people rather than for them. I mean, you can have chemotherapy after chemotherapy, you can have heart implants, you can have all these things, but they may not change your long-term outcome. Surprisingly, we turn off a surprising number of defibrillators in patients that were put in recently because the cardiologist was focused on making sure that they didn't have a cardiac arrest, but not really thinking about the patient is 94 years old and has dementia and their quality of life is terrible anyway. So when they fail to get better with their defibrillator planted in, then they come to us and we'll, if the family wants, turn it off.
What's another myth?
That people will lose hope. There was an excellent study with cancer patients asking them if they and their doctor had described what care they would like if they were dying. And what they didn't know was that they were dying. And they asked the doctors, why haven't you talked with them about this? And they said, oh, we didn't want to get them depressed. Or we didn't want to lose hope. And built into that study, which was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they had a thing called the Hearth Hope Index and another depression screen. And they found out, of course, the day you find out you have a life-ending illness, I'm sure everybody's upset, but people have a natural sense of hope and they just hope for different things. All of us have on our birth certificates an invisible expiration date. We should all be hoping for, you know, that we'll be comfortable, that we'll be with our loved ones, but death is inevitable for all of us. And so we hope for different things.
And you will also explore how to support someone who has been admitted to hospice, from what you should say when someone has been told they are dying to how you can support them.
Well, our chaplains love the phrase. I said, my job as a doctor is to deal with the physical symptoms so that the patients are chaplain ready, so that they can discuss the essential questions, the existential questions of their life. Why am I here? What's my relationship with God? What comes after death? Why do I suffer? Why do I not suffer? And so these are the times for them to have those questions. And I spend a lot of time with medical students saying, if a patient asks you a question like that to you as an authority figure, if you just shut them down and say, I'm a doctor, I don't talk about that stuff, they may never ask what was the most important question of their life is why they're here. Now, I don't have the answers, but exploring the question is usually therapeutic. And so there was another doctor that wrote a book called The Four Things That Matter Most, Dr. Ira Byock. And he talked about the four things to say when you're getting close to the end of life. And they're, I forgive you, please forgive me, I love you, and thank you. There's always the question of what do you say to somebody when you're not sure you're going to see them again? It's kind of like if you've ever gone to the airport and you get out of the cab and the cabbie says, hey, have a great flight. And you turn around and say, yeah, you too. You can get a little awkward. So my usual comment is to say, I wish you peace. But people want to have this conversation. As I mentioned in my book on education of a hospice doctor, my mother went and talked to my college roommate's mother and asked the question, so what does it feel like to be dying? And nobody had allowed her to talk about that. And so my mother was there like 2-3 hours and just came back exhausted, because every time this patient had tried to bring up, I'm sick, I'm dying, everybody kept saying, no, you'll be fine. No, you'll be fine. They were uncomfortable. So some things to talk about is to ask the question, may we discuss what you're going through? I'd like to be supportive. How can I help? And when people emptily say, hey, call me if you need anything, I have never called anybody when I needed something. So it needs to be concrete. I was reading an article recently about somebody who died and somebody outside the family said, I'm going to bring you dinner every day for the next 2 weeks. I said, no. I said, no, I know. If I say, call me if you need anything, you'll not call. So you know that for the next 14 days, I'm going to bring dinner. It needs to be specific, because we all say that, including me, that, you know, hey, call me if you need anything. And then they never call. People are too consumed in their grief. So find something concrete to do. Go over and commiserate. The best way to start the conversation is to ask a question like, how are you doing? And then get past the fine that we all throw back out.
The class is offered through the Chattery. People who want more information about that can go to thechattery.org. Beyond that, where can people go online to follow all that you do?
Welcome Home has a website. I know that Hospice of Chattanooga has additional links as well.
All right, Greg, thanks so much.
Good to see you.
This year's Wine Over Water begins on Monday. As always, the festival will support Cornerstones and its historic preservation efforts here in Chattanooga. But the pandemic means this year's events will be virtual instead of on the Walnut Street Bridge. Kalina Goldsworthy is owner and founder of The Bitter Bottle. She's teaming up with the Chattery to host Wine Over Water's first virtual class on cocktails, Monday, starting at 7 p.m. Kalina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ray.
Tell us more about this online cocktail class for Wine Over Water.
Wine Over Water is such a highly anticipated event here in Chattanooga, and I've been so fortunate to be a part of their steering committee for the last, I guess this would have been my third year to be a part of it. This whole year has been really difficult for everyone, but I love the fact that we're still trying to keep Wine Over Water relevant, to keep it a part of what's happening and give people that sense of escape so that they can kind of have that. Because I think that that's what we loved so much about Wine Over Water anyway. But in a way to be able to allow people to congregate, to talk about wine. We love wine. It's not just about drinking wine. It's about talking about it and learning about it. And so we had this idea to come up with a wine cocktail class. And I think that since we've started through quarantine and through the pandemic in general, a lot of things have taken place online, and we've shifted a lot of classes to being online. And as somebody who's taught a lot of online classes over the last, 5 months, the response has been amazing. It's been super exciting and engaging, and unlike, a lot of the other classes that I teach where I'm doing the making and the instructing and people just get to try things, it's now kind of flipped it over a little bit where we have people that are getting really like tactile and making the drinks themselves, which I love. It's so cool that everybody's in their kitchen. They have all the things that they need, at their disposal, and they can just easily, I say, this is what we're going to do. And I get to watch a screen of, 20 people doing the same thing. So cool. It's so exciting.
And you have been teaching online for months. What have you learned from that experience that you will be applying to this course?
The coolest thing is that we can reach people outside of our normal kind of zones, so to speak. So I haven't seen the guest list yet for the wine cocktails course, but I know we've been branching outside of Chattanooga. So especially we've implemented newly, which we're doing for this wine cocktails class as well, a cocktail kit. So it's a small box that includes all the, non-perishable ingredients that would be needed to create these cocktails, and they're shipped to your house. So we're able to access people and get people the necessary ingredients and things like that that they can do from home, which is really exciting. I think that the other thing that we've learned through doing online cocktail classes that we're working with this is just kind of listening to what people want to bring into their homes. As somebody who's taught so many classes, we've done a lot of test things to see, like, are people excited about this? And honestly, I don't think that there's a better way to gauge people's excitement about things is if they're willing to bring them into your home. And I think that it's very personal, but it's exciting and it's really cool.
Tell us a little bit about each of the three cocktails that people are going to be learning about.
For this cocktail class in particular, we're going to be doing kind of a deep dive into just wine cocktails in general. So a lot of times I can't really hide my love and passion for talking about the history of cocktails. So we're going to do a little bit of that. But really what we're going to be talking about are three very different wine cocktails that have wine as a key ingredient. So we're going to talk about the champagne cocktail, which is a very basic, easy to replicate cocktail. I'd say that's probably the very beginner wine cocktail level, really easy to make it at home, really easy to enjoy it at home. And then we're going to focus on the New York Sour, which is one of my personal favorite cocktails. This one is going to introduce whiskey into the mix as well. And who doesn't love a whiskey cocktail with wine? Kind of sounds like a dangerous mix, but it's honestly one of the most well-balanced and delicious drinks. And we have a couple secrets. I have really enjoyed exploring what we have in our kitchens. So we'll use some really fun and unique ingredients in this drink, like aquafaba, which is the juice that you get from a can of chickpeas. It's an egg white replacement. I feel like it's magic when we work on these the courses, and I get to watch people, open a can of chickpeas with such trepidation and then work it into a cocktail, and it just turns to be this beautiful, amazing, wonderful drink that they've created themselves. Super fun. And then the last cocktail that we're going to do, which is another one of my personal staples and my personal favorites that puts us up a little bit more on the advanced side of things, is making a mulled wine.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I think mulled wine is, we have this sort of connotation to bring this back to like the antiquated times. Nobody really wants things like this until you try it. And then you try it and you think, wow, I don't know why I haven't been doing this for a really long time. You can find a lot of different recipes for it. I personally love to work with a nice red wine, like a Shiraz or something like that. Work in some citrus flavors, a lot of baking spice. And the cool thing about this is if you have a crock pot, you can just kind of set it on low, mix everything in really nicely, and just kind of let it roll. We don't want to boil anything off, obviously, because we don't want to lose a lot of the alcohol content of it. But It's such a winter warmer. It's the perfect drink to accompany, you know, especially now that we're finally getting into fall, to sit around a campfire with some friends and just have a giant pot. You don't have to make, you know, 25 cocktails for your, well, we're probably not having 25 people over anymore. Three cocktails for your friends at any given point in time as you sit around socially distanced fire. You just have, you know, a giant crock pot of wine that you can just serve, and it's warm, and everything about it is just screams for fall and winter time. It's just perfect.
And beyond this course, tell us how your business, The Bitter Bottle, is doing and what your plans are for the business as the months unfold and we head into 2021.
Well, it's kind of crazy to think that I just launched my first product in December of 2019. So it was kind of a crazy roller coaster to launch a product and, you know, the holiday season, and then watch the January, February months tend to be really slow for food and beverage anyway, and then to watch March kind of take it all away. So our primary customer base were bars and restaurants, and with the pandemic, we pivoted really quickly to having an online storefront, which we're focusing on for the holiday season. And as we go into 2021, really been listening to what our customers are looking for. And we found out that honestly, through doing a lot of these courses, that our customers are home bartenders and home enthusiasts. So we've been focusing a lot on doing education in terms of what you can do with bitters and why you should have them at your bar. You know, they're not just for making drinks with, they're for cooking with, adding them to your chilies or your cookies or, you know, a bunch of different things. So we are focusing on creating some smaller options. We saw that we've been selling just 4-ounce bottles. We're selling 1-ounce bottles now, or we will be for the holiday season. We've got some really beautiful gift boxes that we're finishing up right now that I'm really excited about. Having an array of things from like small stocking stuffer sized bitters to, we just released our herbal tinctures line. So even though the pandemic in the last few months have slowed down a lot, the beautiful thing about making bitters is they're good for a long time. And without a lot of people knocking down my door, like the bars and restaurants previously, we've had a ton of time to work on production. So we've worked on some new flavors and a lot of really exciting things to come. You know, this company has been everything to me, and I was so determined to get it off the ground. And it's been a tough year, but we are looking forward into 2021 with some really, really big, exciting ideas.
If you want to participate, where do you go online?
You can visit Wine Over Water's website to purchase the tickets. We're doing it in partnership with the Chattery as well. So if you do, or you're very close with the Chattery and you know that website well, you can visit the Chattery's website and it will redirect you to Wine Over Water's site to purchase the tickets.
And for more information about The Bitter Bottle, where can people go online?
You can go to thebitterbottle.com, or you can follow me on social media at The Bitter Bottle.
All right, Kalina, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Ray.
Each week online, the Bessie Smith Cultural Center here in Chattanooga features community members reading children's books to spur dialogue on race relations. The digital series is called Bessie's Front Porch. And last week, musician Kofi Mawuko read I Got the Rhythm by Connie Schofield Morrison.
I heard rhythm with my ears. So let's see what rhythm we have here and with our ears. And you know what? You can move to the rhythm, you can dance, you can move your body, you can do anything that you want with this rhythm, all right? Can you hear the rhythm with your ears? All right, now go with it. Go for it.
Watch the entire readings from Bessie's Front Porch on the Facebook page and YouTube channel for the Bessie Smith Cultural Center. The next reading appears online at 11 a.m. tomorrow. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is poet, performer, and professor Joshua Bennett. His most recent collection of poetry is titled Ode, a title with more than one meaning. Dr. Bennett has a PhD in English from Princeton. He is currently Mellon Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. He lives in Boston. Dr. Bennett grew up in Yonkers, just north of New York City, where he grew up and where he went first to high school and later to college are two very different worlds. In a recent interview, he said his new collection, Ode, is about the aesthetics of the places I grew up. It's about celebrating things I was taught to denigrate as a boy. It's about do-rags and hoop earrings and high-top fades and ankle weights. It's about my mother's kitchen. It's about the ball court and the bodega. It's about the beautiful, boisterous black life I've lived and singing its beauty for the world as many different ways as I can. This is Token Sings the Blues. It's the poem that opens the collection.
You always are almost always only one in the room. Maybe two. Three is a crowd. Three is a gang. Three is a company of thieves. Three is, wow, there's so many of you. Three will get you confused with people that look nothing like you. You get called Devin. Your name isn't Devin. You do your best not to ignore such casual erasure. You know silence will be received as affirmation, praise even, and you always affirmative. You affirmative action, action figure. You fantastic first black friend. You first ballot quota keeper. You almost cry when your history professor says, you know, in this country, the gold standard used to be people. Funny how no one comes right out and says things like, you people anymore. It's all code words like thug or diversity hire. You diversity all by yourself. You contain multitudes and are yet contained everywhere you go, confined, like there is always someone watching you and isn't there. And isn't that the entire point of this flesh you inherited? This unrepentant stain? Be twice as good, Mama says, as if what they have is worth your panic, worth measuring your very life against, and you always remember to measure. Your hair, your volume, your tone over email, you perpetually sorry. You don't know why. You apologize to no one in particular, just for being around and in your body at the same time. You know your body is the real problem. You monster. You beast of burden. You beast and burden. You horse but human. You centaur. You map the stars and pull back your bow to shoot the moon. And it's one good white eye. You are everything, your big sister says. And on your best days above ground, you believe her.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Is that a picture of your dad on the cover?
That is. Yeah. That is me and my father. Yeah.
He has a nice face.
He's a beautiful man.
He looks so proud of you. You can hardly see his eyes, but there's just the way he's holding his body, the way he's holding you, helping you eat, yeah. You know. He's got you cradled.
He does. Even still, you know, from a distance. He's still that way.
Still alive?
He is. He is. My father is, 71 years old now. Just survived a bout with cancer 3 years ago. And my wife and I, we have a son on the way. My father's the first person I told. Mm. So the cover has new resonance now in so many ways.
Well, you have a great relationship with him. You were quoted as saying that there came a point where your dad started calling you brother.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. He's looking at you more as an equal than as a son.
Yeah, it's the strangest thing. I think I hit a certain age, maybe 30, and it was as if I'd crossed over some bridge, I guess, into a different sort of adulthood where he just seemed to regard me differently, you know, as someone who had, you know, survived a lot in a completely different way than my father has survived a great deal. And he would say, hey, brother, how you doing? And it's like, what? Your dad. You know, how are we brothers? But we are brothers now, you know. We're brothers, me and him.
Which, you know, there's a certain mantle in that, you know. It's like, oh, man, shoot, now I've got to live up to this.
Oh, for sure.
I'm not the son anymore. I realize that maybe not expectations, but hopes. You know, your dad hopes you will fulfill.
No, I think that's right. I mean, in no small part, because I know what my father's relationship to his brothers is like, right? So even in that poem you're referencing, America Will Be, when my father enlisted in the Vietnam War, it was because the recruiter had told him that they wouldn't take two sons from the same family. And his little brother, my uncle, had wanted to go to war. And so as a 17-year-old boy, you know, my father was willing to effectively lay down his life for his younger brother. And so I think about that all the time, you know, the kind of moral courage that must have taken for a child, you know, on the cusp of becoming a man to do something like that.
America Will Be, after Langston Hughes. I am now at the age where my father calls me brother when we say goodbye. Take care of yourself, brother. He whispers a half beat before we hang up the phone, and it is as if some great bridge has unfolded over the air between us. He is 68 years old. He was born in the throat of Jim Crow, Alabama, one of 10 children, their bodies side by side in the kitchen each morning, like a pair of hands exalting. Over breakfast, I ask him to tell me the hardest thing about going to school back then, expecting some history I have already memorized. Boycotts and attack dogs, fire hoses, Bull Connor in his personal tank, candy paint shining white as a slaver's ghost. He says, having to read the Canterbury Tales. He says, eating lunch alone. Now I hear the word America and think first of my father's loneliness. The hands holding the pens that stabbed him as he walked through the hallway, unclenched palms settling onto a wooden desk, taking notes, trying to pretend the shame didn't feel like an inheritance. You say democracy. And I see the men holding documents that sent him off to war a year later, Motown blaring from a country boy's bunker as napalm scarred the sky into jigsaw patterns, his eyes open wide as the blooming blue heart of the light bulb in a Crown Heights basement where he and my mother will dance for the first time, their bodies swaying like rockets in the impossible dark. And yes, I know that this is more than likely not what you mean when you sing liberty, but it is the only kind I know or can readily claim. The times where those hunted by history are underground and somehow daring to love what they cannot hold or fully fathom, when the stranger is not a threat, but the promise of a different ending. I woke up this morning and there were men on television lauding a wall big enough to box out an entire world. Families torn with the stroke of a pen. The right to live, little more than a garment that can be stolen or reduced to cinder at a tyrant's whim. My father knows this, grew up knowing this, witnessed firsthand the firebombs, the Klan, multiple messiahs, love soaked and shot through, somehow still believes in this grand, blood-stained experiment, still votes, still prays that his children might make a life unlike any he has ever seen. He looks at me like the promise of another cosmos. And I never know what to tell him. All of the books in my head have made me cynical and distant, but there's a choir in him that calls me forward. My disbelief, built as it is from the bricks of his belief, not in any America you might see on network news or hear heralded before a football game, but in the quiet power of Sam Cooke singing that he was born by a river that remains unnamed, that he runs alongside to this day, some vast and future country. Some nation within a nation, black as candor, loud as the sound of my father's unfettered laughter over cheese, eggs, and coffee, his eyes shut tight as armories, his fists unclenched as if he were invincible.
Your dad was only 17. I know how I felt when I was 17. That must have been, you know, that's when your guts turn to jelly when you play something like that, you know?
Yeah. Even when you want to ask someone to a dance, or
exactly, exactly. These are major issues that we're dealing with here. You know, is that girl going to turn me down?
Right.
And here's this man volunteering himself to go and sit in some god awful foxhole.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And in the same time period where he's integrating his high school, right? And so often when I think about my relationship with the history in my own writing, part of it is that my dad always seemed to me like a kind of walking textbook, you know, just things that he'd seen, especially in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, coming up to New York City after the war, where he met my mother and, you know, became a mail handler, which is the profession he would occupy for 40 years. You know, he's seen so many different American institutions from a number of different angles, you know, and he trained me to be somebody who valued, you know, love and loyalty and kindness above all else. He was staunchly anti-war my entire life. And he just trained us to value decency, you know, and care.
And he did come of age at such a pivotal time for an African-American man living in the South, mm-hmm. until the end of the 1950s. I guess, as abhorrent as it was, there was a fairly clearly delineated role that you played. That started to shift, but it didn't really. And so it seems to me that in some ways your dad's experience and your experience was the same, in that sense that you have one foot in one reality and one foot in another reality, and the two never communicate.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, so in the beginning of my time at private school, you know, I went to this elite private school in New York called Rye Country Day School. That was about 2 hours away from my neighborhood, you know, via bus and train. And in those earliest days, my first days of freshman year, my father would drive me. And he would always say, you know, I go to this job every day. You know, I work these 10-hour shifts so you can have choices, you know. And so you can figure out a way to navigate the world, which is largely between these poles, you know, that I had to navigate, which was my very diverse, poor and working class neighborhood in South Yonkers, New York. And, you know, going to school with the children of billionaires, you know, and millionaire celebrities. And just navigating that place as someone who had a world that was completely opaque to my classmates, not because they were hateful or anything necessarily. It's just we didn't have any of the same language, you know, when I first got there. They didn't know not just the vernacular, but an understanding of what it meant to fill out financial aid. They didn't understand why in 4 years, you know, I have an award named after me at my high school. My parents set foot there precisely once, you know, for graduation, when I graduated from my high school. But up until that point, they never felt like it was a place where they could be comfortable or really belonged, you know, and it's hard to communicate something like that as a young person, but especially to people who have no real context for you. And I think, yeah, that does have something to do with my father's experience of integrating his high school, at least at the level of that sort of lack of familiarity. Now, he was experiencing levels of brutality that I can't even imagine, sort of the getting stabbed with pens as he walked through the hallway. I mean, that's a literal sort of image. Like, that really happened to him, and people slashed his tires and all this sort of thing. But when I ask him about it, he doesn't lead with those details, right? He says he was lonely sitting at lunch, and he says that he didn't enjoy the Canterbury Tales, right? Those are the ways that he talks about being a high school senior. And that I think is just who my father is. He doesn't think of himself as a hero, right? But he just sort of did what he had to do to survive. And so his kids could have a chance at a better life.
Well, I can concur with him on Canterbury Tales. Chaucer's language is a bit of a challenge, you know. It seems almost impenetrable. But interestingly, and in that sense, it dovetails with James Joyce. I couldn't make sense of either one of them until I heard somebody say it. And all of a sudden it made sense. Whereas when I'm looking at it on the page, and Chaucer kind of the same way, I thought, what the heck is this? And and your work strikes me the same way. It seems to me that African-American culture is first oral, and that everything that we receive, that is the wider world, receive from African-American culture is a kind of, it's almost like a transliteration. The first time I heard Aretha come out of a little transistor radio, as an example. Your mode of expression, it seems to me, is first oral. The way it looks to me on the page when I read it, it's almost like I can hear your voice because of the way it stops at points that is, technically, I guess, it's in the middle of the sentence. Three is a gang. Yeah. Three is a company. That pause, that break, is which I, you know, I see that in so much of your work. I think that's beautiful. It's really finding a way to capture the way people talk on the page.
Thank you so much. That's exactly what I'm after, you know. And some of this, I think, is the fact that the first poets I ever saw were preachers. So it's coming up in the black church where, for some preachers, it was clear that they had notes, at least, right? I saw very few preachers when I was young read sermons, but it's clear they had notes. And for others, it was clear that they had no sort of written transcript whatsoever, right? That they were completely sort of, as they might say, in the spirit, right? But also there's clearly also improvisation that's at play there. And no matter what, if it was a powerful sermon, my mom would say, that's my word for the week, right? And she would carry it with her. And even, you know, after that time as a child in the church, when I first found Poetry Slam and spoken word, there was a similar sort of idea that anything we wrote on the page, we wrote for it to be read aloud, right? We wrote for it to be memorized and performed. And I think my particular style, which actually I guess I haven't talked about that much in interviews, but I always wanted the poems to sound like conversations. I didn't really want to yell or anything like that. I wanted to feel like you were in a room and it was me and you and we were talking and where I was telling you a story. And so when I first really started to commit my life to literary poetry, poetry for the page, I just wanted it to sound beautiful whenever it was read aloud, you know, because that's also how I edit. I edit by doing live readings and I see what lines hit, you know, I see what parts really swing from the audience. And that definitely, I think, is an inheritance of mine from my culture. But also, I think we forget sometimes in the Western world, you know, oral poetry was first. Right, these epic poems, these public recitations, that's an intimate part of the genre that we have to, I think, always hold on to. And it's my first commitment when I go to the page. How does it sound? Right? Where is the music? And how does it serve the story that I'm trying to tell?
The next Black national anthem will naturally begin with a blues note. Some well-adorned, love-lorn lyric about how your baby left and all you got in the divorce was remorse and a mortgage and a somewhat morbid, though mostly metaphorical, obsession with the underground, with how it feels to live in such unrelenting emptiness, unseen, altogether uncorrectable by the state's endless arms. Just imagine Ellison's prologue set to the most elaborate Metro Boomin instrumental you can fathom, brass horns and pulsar cannons firing in tandem as Aretha lines a hymn in the footnotes. 12.5 minutes of unchecked, bass-laden braggadocio, an ode to the unwanted, the most imitated, incarcerated human beings in the history of the world, and every nanosecond of the band's boundless song belongs to us. It is ours, the way the word overcome, or The Wiz, or Herman Melville is ours. In every corner store and court of law, every barbershop argument, or hours-long spat over spades, the next Black national anthem will, by the rule, begin in blood and span our centuries-long war against oblivion, elaborate the anguish at the core of our gentleness, how even that generosity is a kind of weapon. This music, a bladed criticism of a country obsessed with owning everything that shimmers or moves with a destination in mind. Even the sky, even the darkness behind our eyes when we dream.
It's interesting to me the way you choose to put your poems on the page. Sometimes they're in verse form, sometimes they're still really verse, but they're written just like a long, continuous paragraph.
Mm. Yeah, big block.
Yeah.
Like American Octogenarian, yeah. Or the High Top Fade poem, which is a shape poem. It's shaped like a high top fade, yeah.
So you have fun with the page, don't you?
I do. It's a playground for me, you know, and I think, I mean, and Martha Nussbaum talks about this a little bit, I think, in Love's Knowledge, but I think style itself makes its own kind of argument, right? And so for me, I'm always playing with, you know, some tercets and quatrains and couplets. There's a pair of sestina in this book. There are poems that are more like sonnets. Like, I'm always trying to think of form just as a way to operate in yet another register of expression at the same time. Not just what is the poem saying, but how does it look and how does it elaborate itself over the space of the page? You know, I'm also someone that just has moved between a lot of different forms in my life, between sermons and freestyle hip hop verses and, you know, formal research articles and lectures. So when I step to the page, I'm always thinking, how do I bring to bear the forms of my life? Right? Because we're all working in forms every day, right? Some are more literal than others, right? If you go to get a driver's license, you're filling out a certain set of forms or you're filling out your taxes or anything like this, right? You're writing a letter to a friend. You're writing an email. These are different forms we're working in. And so for me, when I write poetry, I just think, well, let's bring that diversity of forms, you know, to the forefront. Because I think it gives different sorts of doors that people can enter into the work.
It also strikes me that, as so many musicians have told me, that The music is as much in the silence as it is in the notes.
Oh, yes, I think that's right.
And you use silence a lot. You know, those breaks, in a sense, are silence, right? The same way a musician uses, like B.B. King, for instance, you know, plays a note and then it kind of hangs in the air for a moment. It serves as a sort of punctuation point.
No, I think that's right. I always want to use my line breaks that way. And I appreciate that you picked up on that, especially in Token Sings the Blues, because I think I'm always thinking, of course, of the line as its own world. Like, I think in poetry, the line is sort of the unit of meaning, right? So with my breaks, I always want there to be an element of surprise or development. It should always help with the pacing of the poem or give you a kind of unexpected moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right after. And I think that's something unique that you can't necessarily do in prose in the same way. So if I'm telling a story in poetry as opposed to prose, I'm always thinking, okay, well, what can the lines do here that make this a different sort of experience for the reader or the speaker?
Yeah, or a preacher.
Or a preacher, indeed.
I thought it was interesting that you said you have three distinct careers, because just by virtue of the conversation we've had up to this point, it seems apparent to me that the writer, the performer, and the teacher are all there all the time in everything you do.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. It was something I got in a lot of trouble for in graduate school.
Can relate to that.
Yeah, you know, I definitely had a particular advisor who I stopped working with, but who said, you know, no one would ever take me seriously as a literary critic if I kept doing the performance stuff. And so I'm really glad I ignored that advice, because it's changed my life, you know, to travel places and do poems and help children write poetry and to now teach creative writing. I mean, I think my career in spoken word is a big part of what brings students to my classes. I think it's a big part of why I got a job. You know, I think people saw the YouTube material and they saw that I was moving in a lot of different spaces. And I would never give a student that kind of advice. You know, I think bring the fullness of what you are to what you're doing. You know, in any place that doesn't want that, they don't want you. Right? But there's no point in lying and diminishing yourself. So I'm glad, because I think I'm trying to do a better job of wearing all those hats at once, though it is, of course, difficult to wear three hats, but it's also innovative, maybe, in certain ways you can pull it off.
The beauty of your book is that in some respects, perhaps, at the heart of your book is Micah. You know,
yeah.
that character, that person, that he's transcendent, like your dad. And it just, and like the music of the people who lived in those South African townships, like Kavusi Malasela, his new album is a celebration of his grandmother and the speakeasy that she ran in this little township, you know, and that music has so much life and so much joy. And you think, how could music that sounds like that come out of such a tormented culture? But the same could be said for the music of Motown that took your dad through the war.
Hmm. Yeah, Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
For once in my life, he said he would listen to in the bunker, you know. Yeah, I mean, but I think those things are linked, right? Like the beauty and terror are linked together, right? The beauty of the music, the blueness of the music, right? In many ways is the kind of... The blue is that central space between the beauty and the terror, right? It's what Ellison, I think, says about the blues, right? That it's catastrophe lyrically expressed, right? So, yeah, there's something about the music, something about the poetry, the fiction, the plays, you know, that the film that emerges from that space, as Audre Lorde said, you know, surviving what you were never meant to survive, right? Both that joy and that melancholy, I think, is the foundation of Black art. And I'm incredibly proud to emerge from that tradition. You know, it taught me a great deal about human endeavor, right? Black people are human beings, and that is always at the forefront of my work as well. And it's why you'll find poems in this book, of course, about, you know, about state violence, right, about the police, about schools. But you'll also find poems about me eating, you know, breakfast at IHOP with my dad, and about jumping rope with girls by the hardware store and you know, riding the bench in high school, you know, on my high school basketball team. All of those textures, I think, are critically important for me as a writer, because my world is all of those things. right? And I'll even say it's never more one of those things than the other necessarily, right? That of course I have the day's tragic news always in my mind, right? And at the same time, I'm always excited about getting my son's nursery together, or about the flower, the daisies in the backyard, or about going for a swim, or the lesson I'm going to teach, you know, in 2 weeks. All of those things are always on my mind. And I think the work that Black artists create in this moment, right, that so many folks are creating, you know, it needs to speak to that fullness, to the fullness of Black life. And it has to make an insistence upon that, I think. So I'm just really trying to do my part, I guess, is what I'm saying, you know, to speak to that tradition of Baldwin and Lord and so many others, because they paved the way for me to be my full self and use all the language I have available to tell this this beautiful story.
And a kind of miraculous alchemy.
Alchemy is right.
My goal is to tell the truth about the world as I understand it. You were quoted as saying that. And I think that's exactly, you know, what you're saying, that when you're able to go deep enough to hit an elemental truth, it's both transcendent and also a it's kind of a reminder of both at the same time, that this is a veil of tears, but there's also real joy here, and we shouldn't lose sight of either one.
Yeah.
We live at that nexus between the two, you know?
Yeah. I think that's right. And my work is an attempt to, you know, honor that nexus and what exists there. Like, I think that nexus is its own site of creation and conviviality and possibility. This is fantastic. Thank you so much, Richard.
And you too. I hope we get to talk again.
Yeah, let's do it. I would love that.
Okay, great. Thanks for your time.
Anytime. I'll talk to you soon.
Joshua Bennett's most recent collection is called Ode. On listener-supported radio, this is Scenic Roots, talking writing.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.